This is Andy.
And this is Matt.
And you're listening to
The Hop Podcast with No Name.
What a dumb name.
It's so stupid. You didn't think I was going to hit record, did you? And here we are, episode 36. You thought I was going to go over there and mess with the computer?
No, no. You just, we're on. We're here.
And I like
we're
that ready. Today my chair is facing away from you. So I don't really have to listen to you. I just am forced to because there's headphones on my head. But I'll ignore you the best I can.
You are really not looking at me.
No, I'm looking right at the door out of the room that I get to leave. Once this is over, I get to go right through that one. That's nice. Not true. We have work later.
Excellent. Do you remember what we're talking about today?
I do, because I listened to the episode on the way up here.
Do you listen to our own podcast on the way
up? Correct. That's how narcissistic I am. I cut you out too. I skip through the parts that you're talking. I just go through and listen to mine. Wow. This is...
Okay. So what did we say we were talking about?
We were talking about, last episode was about learning differently. Think differently, to learn differently, design differently. And then yes. We were going to this episode talk about resilient design and designing differently and what that means. And then you were going to tell some stories. So
all right,
pretty much an average episode. So if your expectations are up here listening, okay, well, we'll see. We get there.
All right. Sounds like a plan. And I think the reason why we thought it was important to talk about designing differently is because... So oftentimes in talking about this hop space, it almost comes as like an afterthought, the designing differently piece of it. There's a lot of discussion about how to lead, how to engage with people, how to have really good operational learning conversations, sort of the thought process that we have to adjust in order to be able to hear people. And then the designing differently aspect of it, depending upon who you're listening to in this space, just kind of, I don't know, it's just... It's there, but it's sort of weaker in the discussion than it probably should be, myself included, in how I tend to talk about it. And what we tend to see happening in organizations that have been doing, you know, using hop concepts for a while is that we get to a certain point in learning. And so people are really good at learning from the end user. But there isn't a lot of change happening in design. And sometimes there's sort of a confusion around what the idea of learning and improving means, meaning that thought process is that we're going to learn from our mistakes and improve, but the improvement in some places isn't including actually changing the design of anything. It's just, we did that before, so we're not going to do it again. Mm-hmm. That sort of improvement, which is not the intent of the idea of resilient design.
Which let me just reiterate that. So We before we got on the call, we're talking about where the goalposts are.
Why are we even doing this hop stuff? What is the point?
Where's the finish line, right? And so I think traditionally, or maybe most common thought is, I'm at the finish line. I'm doing hop when we're at a place where we can operationally learn or do learning teams well,
mm-hmm.
and
put in solution sets from
exactly,
them.
We
right,
define the problems very well, and then we use those doing the work to create the solutions, and then we put them in.
Yes.
And that's it. We've done it.
We've nailed it.
We've done hop, check on to the next. And what we're saying is there's actually a whole nother lap to this race. It is this idea of resilient design.
And it can happen within operational learning, right? Like that's the intent of being able to define the problems well, and putting in improvements. It's just, I guess we haven't seen a lot of examples in practice of people defining the problems in a way that would push you towards resilient design or designing to allow to fail safely. There's a lot of different terminology you can use depending upon sort of, you know, whose books you've read or where you've studied this information. And so we'll probably use a few of them to hopefully make it make sense to people. But the idea of designing something that can account for or absorb variability. So you're going to have real life variability. And part of that comes from humans being humans, right? We're adapting in the moment, but we're also making errors and mistakes. And part of it comes from other variability of just environmental variability or process variability in terms of, you know, if the inputs to your process, there's a lot of it. And you can design in a way that can absorb some of that. So even if you have unforeseen, unplanned, unscheduled changes to things, the end result isn't catastrophic. And there's kind of two pieces of the puzzle that become really important. The first is that you can't predict everything. And so even designing in this space, in this resilient design space, because we can't predict everything, it's really hard to design for everything, which means that this idea of learning and improving quickly becomes important. We don't even know there's a problem unless we're really good at operational learning and we can sort of catch weak signals and have conversation and see things are changing close to real time as possible. Because although we can't predict ahead of time that something unpredictable is going to happen, certainly we can see as it's happening and learn from people as it's happening. The other piece is in places where we know something bad has occurred, can occur, will occur, designing to allow us to fail safely in those circumstances. And that's kind of the place that I don't know we do necessarily well in a lot of organizations is, hey, we already know that this really bad outcome has happened. Or we've seen that the pieces of the puzzle for it to happen are there. And we spend a lot of time trying to prevent those pieces of the puzzle coming together, but we don't always look at the mitigation aspect of it, of just saying, okay, I'm going to take it as a given that at some point there's going to be enough variability, whether that's a person messing something up or something else, that we are going to get to this, whatever you could call it, loss of control. We're going to get to this bad place, this place none of us ever really wanted to be in. And then asking ourselves the question of, well, now what? Let's assume we're here and now what? Which I think Dr. Todd Conklin says, we want to design for not if, but when, right? When we're in that place.
So just to be clear.
Yes.
What we're saying is if you're doing operational learning, great.
Keep doing
it. If you're defining problems well with your teams, great. If you're then making changes, great. And we're just trying to keep going a step further, right?
Yes. We just want to add on to the thought process of what are we making changes around? Is it just sort of find it, fix it, tangibly obvious stuff once you talk to the folks that are close to the work that they're like, hey, I don't have this tool when I need it. Is that the type of fix we're only doing? Or are we also thinking about how we're designing to allow ourselves to fail safely? Have we added that into the thought process?
Yeah, so that's still a good answer.
Right? Correct.
Hey, we need this tool. Yes. Yeah, well, sorry, you don't get it. Andy and Matt put out an episode that means we have to really think about resilience, and so I can't give you this tool yet until, no, get them the tool. And then also when you're looking at your system, start thinking about it in this way.
Yes, and I don't know a better way of talking to this place that we're trying to get you to without using a story or an example, because I just, maybe I'm just not smart enough to teach it any other way, but,
maybe
probably. But what I think might be helpful is if I talk to the first time that designing to fail safely made sense to me. And then maybe people can extrapolate that thought out to other places. Because the first time that type of design made sense was unfortunately in the wake of a really serious event where we had an employee that was working with a rotating drill bit and he got his fingers very seriously injured, actually all of them broken, and lost two of them and a tendon. And part of how that happened was in working, if you can picture an end mill, if not just picture a rotating drill bit, he was brushing away metal chips with a brush while this was rotating and the bristles of the brush got pulled in. And then his hand got pulled in and he had a glove on his hand. And so the fingers of the glove got pulled in and then he instinctively grabbed for the hand that was pulled in with the other hand, and that hand got pulled in, and he was able to turn off the end mill with the emergency stop with his forehead. But by then, the damage to his hands had already been done. I went to the hospital right after this event and met the employee, and I met him there. And I remember very distinctly a moment in time. He was actually in so much shock, he wasn't in pain, I don't think, at the time. And he was talking out loud. I would have told you he was talking to me if you asked me, but in retrospect, he probably didn't even process that I was sitting there. And I remember he was looking down at his hands and every finger that he had remaining was going in the wrong direction. And as he was looking at his hands, he said, I'll never be able to do my job again, will I? And this is a person that's doing a lot of maintenance work, very, you know, hands-on, intense. And the answer was probably not. He probably wasn't going to be able to do the same job.
And I mean, there's a deeper meaning there, right? I imagine his entire career.
Correct.
And the livelihood that he provided for with his family.
Yes.
Was based off of doing this work.
And I had an enormous amount of empathy in that moment, but that feeling was competing with frustration, anger, a feeling of helplessness and hopelessness. Because from the seat I was in, I felt personally responsible for the fact that this event had happened, right? I was an environmental health and safety leader covering this area, and I felt personally responsible that I had not done enough to prevent the event. That was my thought process at the time. I hadn't done enough to prevent this event. And at the same time, we had some rules in place that were designed to prevent the event that from the initial analysis of what had happened seemed like they had been broken. And then later on, we found out conclusively that these rules had not been followed. And the two rules I was very frustrated about was the fact that on that specific piece of equipment, we had a rule that you shouldn't wear gloves. And actually, that was a standing rule at the facility. You never wear gloves around rotating equipment. And it was such a specifically like talked about rule that I personally had put a sticker on that very piece of equipment, like a yellow sticker that says, do not wear gloves while operating. And he had been wearing gloves. And then the other piece of the puzzle was the fact that there was guarding in place to prevent you from getting your hand exposed to something that was rotating. And that guarding had been moved in order to brush the chips away. So as much empathy as I had in that moment, I was also incredibly angry. And that anger came from a place of feeling hopeless and helpless because how was I supposed to, if people weren't going to follow basic rules, how was I supposed to keep anybody safe? That was my thought process at the time. And I waited until his family came to the hospital and I got them a cup of coffee. And then I went into my car and I screamed. I just sat in the car and I screamed. And I brushed it off and said, okay, well, now that you've, you know, had your emotional bout, it is time to go figure out what to do differently. And I went back to my office at the time and I remember staring at my computer and there was a slide that I had printed out from one of Dr. Todd Conklin's presentations and it was sitting right above my computer and the slide said something to the effect of great performance is not the absence of mistakes. It's the presence of capacity. And I conceptually vaguely understood what that meant, but that was about as much as I understood. Like it was really interesting words. And I had printed that slide out because it felt important, but I could not at the time have articulated what it actually meant.
I knew what each one of those words mean individually.
Individually, right?
But together,
like what does capacity mean? Like, what do we mean by capacity? And the only example that I had been given up until that time was the example of car design. So I want to take a quick aside into the car design and talk a little bit about it to help make sense of what this idea of failing safely and capacity means. But many people have heard the example, right? So we're not going to go into crazy detail. And also the example itself didn't help me very much. So that's actually what I want to talk to is after knowing the example, what else did I need to know in order to understand how you actually apply this thought process into something that isn't cars? Because the example that I was given was looking at car design from, you know, the 50s and 60s to today, that the cars are designed anticipating, expecting that the human at some point will fail in some capacity, meaning we're going to make an error, we're going to make some sort of mistake, and a crash will occur. And then the design is set so that when the crash does occur, how can you still have the driver walk away? Right? So things like bumpers, things like airbags, crumple zones, seat belts, all of these engineering defenses built into the car to create physical survivable space with the acknowledgement that the car will most likely eventually be crashed. And when it is crashed, what does that crash look like? And how do we make it so that the person can walk away? So that this idea of failing safely, right? So we've failed, right? But we've failed in a way that we've controlled the outcome of the fail. The consequence has been minimized to some extent. Now the car is still destroyed. Don't get me wrong. Like there is consequence, but that consequence is far lesser than it would be in another circumstance. We destroy the car in order to preserve the person, right? The energy has to go somewhere. That's the design element of it.
And you make that trade-off 10 times out of 10.
Correct.
It's a very easy trade-off.
Yes. And it is a trade-off that was made intentionally.
Yep.
It didn't happen by accident. There was a decision made that the car will be crashed. Now what? Right? That was the thought process. And I had heard that example many times, but I didn't know what to do with it, meaning an end mill and a glove and a person with using or not using guarding felt so distinctly different from cars. I couldn't draw the connection. I can't put airbags in it, right? Like
Not with that attitude. You can't.
I don't know how to make bumpers, right? I couldn't apply the design elements to it. And so I didn't know what to do with the information. And so instead I actually became really interested, not in what was changed in the design of cars, but how it was changed. And there's a couple pieces in the how, which is where we get to why there's so much emphasis in the other parts of HOP, because the pieces to the how are this. The first piece is the recognition that people are fallible and there will be an accident, which is sometimes hard for us to admit to ourselves, right? We want people to be perfect. We want our processes to be perfect. So you have to first say it will happen. Maybe not super frequently, but we're going to change the probability in our mind from some number that we've calculated to one. And we're just going to use that as the assumption. It will happen. And then now what? In order to get to a place where you even want to start to spend resourcing in that space, you then have to get beyond the idea that an event is happening just because somebody was being an idiot, and that if they just weren't being an idiot, then this wouldn't happen. And so all we have to do is make it so that our people aren't idiots, right? Like that's the other piece of the puzzle that we have to be able to tackle. And then the third part is you have to know enough about the system to design it differently. And that's actually a really big hurdle in a lot of organizations. Like you can't just wish your way to resilient design. It doesn't work that way. You can't just like sit in your chair in an office somewhere and be like, I want to make this design resilient, and then sit there with a piece of paper and figure out how that's going to happen.
Well, that's sort of true because you can.
Say more.
You can do that. You can say, I'm, as an outside observer, going to believe I'm making the right change to a system.
Correct.
It's just
whether or not it's effective.
Yeah. And those doing the work might say, oh, thank you for this. It's going to live in the closet over there. We're never going to touch it or use it, but thank you for that. And they just ignore it.
Yes.
So
yeah,
you can do it.
You can do it. You are absolutely right. You can do it. It just probably isn't going to land the way that we want it to. Meaning that we don't have enough tangible details of how the work is getting done to design it well. And so then this is the thought process where it's incredibly important to have the end user in the design. And so this, combining these concepts, is when I started to understand a bit of how the automotive industry changed car design. And there's a lot of moving pieces to it, but there is one very, very large element that they have that is an advantage that a lot of other industries don't have. And that's that every single person on the design team also drives. So the end user is the designer. And there's some other spaces in the world where that exists. And actually the products that they create are often really good because they are beta testing things as they're designing it. And they understand the nitty gritty details of what it's like to actually use the piece of equipment or do the work. And so it was in understanding this that I started to think about even examples in car design itself of, well, how do you design for something differently? And the example that stuck with me that seemed so helpful, and then getting to talk to people that actually design cars and how they come up with ideas, right? So reinforce this thought process of, let's imagine that you're driving and maybe you're managing a bunch of people that are driving, and you find out that somebody changed lanes and didn't check their blind spot, and there was an event because of it. There's some collision, and as the person managing these drivers, that hits your scorecard, there's some amount of resourcing that you need to fix the piece of equipment or fix the car, and so we're generally not happy when we have a negative outcome. Now, if you don't drive, right, your thought process is usually fairly simplified of, well, they know they should have checked their blind spot. I've seen it in the training. I actually trained to it. I know the requirements. And if I look at the procedure, it's in the procedure. And so we sort of oversimplify the thought process to, well, they should have checked their blind spot and they didn't. And then we tend to tackle that as the problem, meaning we try to get people to check their blind spot more often. We try to make it sure that they understand how important it is. We try to put in higher man-made consequences to force people to check their blind spot. We do a lot of things to try to double down on the idea of always remember, never forget, check your blind spot every time. We do campaigns around it. If you're the end user and somebody suggests those solution sets to you, they feel a little bit silly. And they feel silly because they're hollow, they're empty, they're flat. They don't have enough context to it. And a healthy way to start to resolve this problem is, rather than just picking this one thing that we find to be a preventative failure, instead we learn what is actually happening. And what we mean by that in this case is the fact that if you talk to drivers, right, all of us, if we had conversation, we would find that it is actually fairly normal for people to not check their blind spot for a few reasons. One, I think we've mentioned this before when we were talking about like errors and mistakes, but one, you meant to do it and you plumb forgot, or two, you didn't check it on purpose because you were 100% certain at that point in time that there was no one there, right? For some sort of specific contextual reason, you were 100% certain. You turned out to be wrong, but in the moment you were 100% certain. That is a lot easier to digest when you're the end user because you've experienced part of it. But then the other piece, right, in the design piece, the thing that is so incredibly powerful to be learning about is, how are we managing that today? Meaning there isn't a lot of the potential for that accident to happen is pretty high, and yet it doesn't happen all the time. So what is happening in that space between the time that we've lost control, right? We plumb forgot, or we didn't check our blind spot. So now we are trying to change lanes with someone in our blind spot. What happens between that moment and the time that we don't have an accident, right? So that's this area of learning from the end user and the adaptation and all of the operational learning we're talking about. But the really valuable piece of understanding what is happening is because we can take that solution set and make it systemic. Meaning we find out, for example, what's happening is that someone who is in the blind spot hopefully sees you, honks their horn, and you as the driver, you're alerted and you correct lanes. That is the mechanism that's preventing the incident from happening at that moment in time. Hearing an attention activator that somebody else is hopefully creating for you, hearing it and having enough time to respond. And when you know that level of detail of how we're managing not to have incidents or as many incidents today, that's when the idea of a blind spot detector starts to make sense. Like, that's when you have enough contextual information that it would be like, huh, you know what? We could make that same solution set happen almost all the time by making it systemic, by building it into the car itself. We're going to make the car that you're in be the attention activator instead of the other not reliable human, right, that's in the other car. And we're actually going to make an attention activator in a couple different ways. We're going to make it flash and make noise so that you have a couple different ways of catching that there's a problem. And then that's going to be at least part of a solution for how we reduce the probability of any consequence after that loss of control. Loss of control has still happened. You're still in a position you never intended to be in, trying to move into a lane where there's no space for you. But this design feature makes it less likely that you are going to hit the car that is in the blind spot. It is that thought process of learning from the end user, being able to get beyond the biases of, well, somebody should have just done something better, or somebody should have just chanted their blind spot. Somebody shouldn't have been wearing gloves. Somebody should have just had the guarding in place. Being able to learn from that, learn how today success is created, if success is being created in other circumstances, and then seeing whether or not we can actually take that solution set that is being used and make it into something systemic that is available either more often or to everyone or consistently or reliably. And that is a really big piece of how to get to an end state of a better design, which we can go back to the glove story next episode to see how it actually applies in a non-car example, because that's the big hurdle. It's so getting to that.
Your quick aside was about 12 minutes. It was, I think, more than half the episode. Also, big shout out to whoever the plum salesman was that talks to the forgetful people, because you said plum forgot like 6 times. That's a saying, I guess. So thank you all for listening. We're going to pick up the story about the actual
event, the yep. wearing of the gloves, the resilient design within the use of the gloves.
Which we call the glove story. So we're going to finish the glove story. Next episode.
Yeah.
And we'll see you then. Thanks for listening.
Well, that's it.
Yep. Another one in the books. We did it.
If you want to send us any of your thoughts, actually fling us any of your thoughts, you can do so at the website www.hoppodcast.com.
That's hoppodcast.com.
It's still such a stupid name.
We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening.